This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From a relaxing vacation on Earth.
Greetings, Captain. I do not think you realize the gravity of your situation.
To the most perilous reaches of space. Only one crew dare travel where no man has ever gone before.
We'll need all the power you can muster, mister.
On a desolate planet, a renegade Vulcan seeks ultimate knowledge.
To find it, we'll need a starship.
And he will stop at nothing to get it.
I dreamt that a madman had taken over the Enterprise.
You look like you've just seen a ghost.
Perhaps I have, Captain. Our destination is the planet Sha'Kari, Eden, at the center of the galaxy.
The center of the galaxy can't be reached.
If you ask me, and you haven't, I think this is a terrible idea. We're bound to bump into the Klingons.
Remain on course.
To Kirk, he's a fanatic to be fought.
You know we'll never make it through the Great Barrier.
I say the danger is an illusion.
To the crew, he's a mystic to be followed.
Cyborg has simply put us in touch with feelings that we've always been.
I have to get back to the transporter.
To Spock, he's the past he must confront.
Shoot him!
You know I'm right.
Spock, my only concern is getting the ship back. And you're either with me or you're not.
Put him in the brig with Captain Kirk.
I'm a prisoner on my own ship.
What are you standing around for? Do you not know a jailbreak when you see one?
Mr. Scott, you're amazing.
There's nothing amazing about it. I know this ship like the back of my hand.
Emergency channel open.
A hostile force has taken control of our vessel. Put us on a direct course with the Great Barrier.
Understood, Enterprise. We are dispatching a rescue ship immediately.
Kirk!
Bird of Prey bearing 105, Mark 2.
Let me do something.
Mr. Sulu, full ahead.
Transfer power to warp drive. Warp speed now.
The greatest enterprise of all is adventure. Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
That was an awesome trailer. Unfortunately, there's more to it. Welcome, everyone, to yet another chapter of our continuing series here on Pop Goes the Classics, here in the Place to Be Nation Pop feed of the original Star Trek movie franchise. Yes, we have reached this one. Odd and even. Well, we know that that's mostly BS. Except this one. Tonight, Star Trek V, the final movie. No, most people might have thought it would have been. No, Star Trek V, the final frontier. I am, of course, your co-host, Scott Priscolo. Joining me, former purveyor of OpenTheFridge.net and a frequent collaborator here to the Pop Feed, Rob Piontek, a.k.a. Tech. You know what I think I want done? Wouldn't it be great if, not to sound morbid, but like when we die down the line, whenever that is, hopefully not for quite a long time, either Bob Peak or Drew Struzan does a poster of us. I would love that. I don't know why I just thought that, but how cool would that be?
Lofty goals.
It is lofty. I know it is, really. Always a pleasure, sir. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I have to ask you a question, though, Scott.
Yes.
Why is Captain Kirk climbing a mountain? Why is he climbing a mountain?
His mountain, and he calls the shots in this one. fake or not. Yes. So, just to recap, through the first four movies, here are our grades. Tech's grades are 36, 48, 42, and 39 from 1 through 4. Mine are 34.5, 49.5, 43, and 37.5. So, we both have the same order. Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock, Voyage Home, and the motion picture so far. So we now fast forward 3 years. The movie comes out on June 9th, 1989. So for the second time in 7 years, Tech, Star Trek puts a movie out amongst possibly the greatest movie year in the history of pop culture.
Yeah, you better believe it.
And we thought 82 was full of heavyweights. At least that movie was good. Just to recap very briefly, let's go back to 1982 when The Wrath of Khan came out. Also coming out in 1982 was, let's see, let me bring the list up very quickly. Also coming out in 1982 was Death Wish 2. Cat People. Basket Case, good horror movie. We talked about that. Diner, Conan the Barbarian, Annie, which was a big deal back then. Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, Rocky III, Poltergeist, which came out the same day as Wrath of Khan did, E.T., Blade Runner, The Thing, The Secret of Nim, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Friday the 13th Part 3, Officer and a Gentleman, The Beastmaster, Amityville 2, The Possession, Pink Floyd, The Wall, First Blood, meaning the first Rambo movie. I don't think we mentioned that one last week. I think we did. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, Creepshow, 48 Hours, The Verdict, Airplane 2, The Sequel, which is damn funny, Sophie's Choice, great movie, The Toy, The Dark Crystal, Tootsie, yeah, not exactly a, throwaway year in 1982. And Wrath of Khan held its own big time.
Absolutely.
Held its own. This one. Sorry. We're trying not to chuckle so much. All right. Let's get to brass tacks before we slaughter it when we talk about 1989 movies. Okay. So we fast forward 3 years after part four. Leonard Nimoy has directed back to back, and both movies were exceptional. But the Shat will not be outdone. My turn. I wanna. All right, fine. William, you could fucking direct. Jesus Christ, just shut up. So William Shatner is our director. Harv comes back. Harv Bennett comes back as producer. Our story... a renegade Vulcan is searching for God at the center of the galaxy. Yeah, that's about it. I got nothing.
That's the long and short of it.
Pretty much.
Yeah, where to begin, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of.
I mean, you touched on what is the first red flag, which was William Shatner essentially saying, "I'll be in Star Trek 4 if you let me direct Star Trek 5." And of course, the movie needing its captain, they just kind of acquiesced, not really knowing what they had committed themselves to.
Yeah, I obviously, as you can tell from the. Special feature interviews that you've been watching this week and that I had watched previously, and we both watched many times on our special edition 2-disc DVD sets. William has a healthy envy, and that's being diplomatic, for his good friend Leonard. Oh, they love Leonard. Oh, they fawn over Leonard. They take Leonard out. They buy Leonard gifts. They love Leonard. You're like, oh my God.
I taught Leonard everything he knows. I've been directing TV long before Leonard was directing features. Oh my God, step off it, Bill.
You're a fine actor. We'll get more to that. So he directs.
And gets co story credit. It's him, Harv Bennett, and David Lowery get the story credit, and I believe David Lowery gets the screenwriting credit. And I mean, that man is the real hero of this movie because he tried admirably.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, because it's the moments from the page between the characters that are the saving. I mean, it doesn't save the movie, but they are the saving grace of this movie. In my opinion, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like here's one thing that I've always said about the plot. I don't know if you and I have ever talked about this, but I feel like they dipped into the Spock well one too many times. Spock is pretty much the underlying character in the trilogy. Even in the last one, to a certain extent. Not as much, obviously, as the first two, but definitely. I feel like we needed to get off the Spock thing and come up with something different. Instead, now we have Spock's brother that's fucking crazy. Like, I feel like I understand that everybody loves Spock, and Spock is one of the most enduring TV and movie characters in sci-fi history. But do we really need another Spock plot? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know, I never even thought about that, but you're right. I mean, yeah, he is kind of obviously he's the crux of three, but as a result of his actions in two and, yeah, the follow-up in four. Yeah, I mean, yeah, his relationship is the one that not necessarily kicks off the story, but lets the story go where it ends up, because there is the point where Cybok, we'll jump ahead a bit here. Cybok is, you know, kind of incapacitated once they get on board the Enterprise, and Kirk is like, shoot him. You know, this is the bad guy. Let's get rid of him before he even knows his true familial nature. And it's Spock who spares his life because he's his half brother and kind of gets them into the rest of that mess.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just thought that, I mean, I get it. We love Leonard. It's not really Leonard's fault. He's just the actor, but I mean, I love Spock and everything, but do we really need another Spock-centric plot? I mean, I feel like we dipped into that well already through the first three movies, the previous three movies, not necessarily motion picture, even though he was in it and he was kind of half out of it when he first got there, but the movie wasn't about him, whereas clearly two, three, definitely two, well, not really two till the end, almost all of three and a little bit of four. I feel like we needed to get away from Spockish stuff and move on to kind of a different plot, and I feel like going back to Spock was just going to the well. It's almost like Shatner wanted to try to be his own guy, yet, Leonard, I'm going to borrow your character again and make this movie. Because he knows that Spock is beloved. And Kirk is too. We know that. But Spock's loved too. So I feel like they should have kind of branched off and did another story and got off the Spock thing. So I give the plot, and the whole plot is like kind of goofy. I don't know if this was Shatner and the writers and Lowry trying to, I don't know, a commentary on religion. I never really thought that's what they were trying to do and were inadvertently trying to do it. But I don't know. It kind of worked. It seemed very confusing. And it all in the end just was like one big screw job. Yeah, pretty much in the end.
Yeah, the movie's a bit of a mess.
Yeah. So I'm giving the plot a 4.
Oh, wow, that's generous. The plot of this movie is just silly. Spock's half brother. I was contacted by God to come and find him at the center of the galaxy. Okay. And like you throw in this like this random renegade Klingon bird of prey that's just like, oh, I want to kill James T. Kirk. I'm going to hunt him down and kill him for no reason. It's dumb. I give the plot of this movie a 2. And it gets a 2 because while the plot is weak and lacking and just poorly put together, I give it the 2 points for the message behind this plot. And I'm not talking about like religion and, the message that really reached out to me that I can't take credit for this statement, but it's from the DVD. The message behind this movie is the search for, you know, answers and meaning between the beyond and the intimate. And it's all succinctly stated by Kirk at the very end when they're having a little goofy ass reception. And they say, is God really out there? He goes, maybe he's not out there. Maybe he's here. And he points to his heart. that what we are looking for is not, you know, an entity, so to speak, that may be existing somewhere that we can physically go find and interact with. It's with who you are, who the people are around you, and how you choose to, you know, form those bonds, those relationships. And that's where the movie shines. And we'll come back to this point in the cast, because it's the cast that, you know, in addition, the writing for this cast and their performances of said writing that, you know, allows this movie to shine. But yeah, the plot is weak. It's not good.
It really isn't good.
The movie starts with Cybok on this planet, and he's like, I'm in need of a starship to, complete my quest. And the first question you got to ask yourself is, well, then how did you get here?
Yeah.
You're on Nimbus 3, the armpit of the galaxy, you know, this desert planet where it's Mad Max meets Mos Eisley, because it's just... Yeah. You know, the smattering of scruffily, you know, garbed aliens, you know, eking out existence in a bar in Paradise City, you know, Nimbus 3, the planet of galactic peace, you know, and this is a whole plot point. They come up with this like, oh, you know, we had a joint venture between the Romulan, Klingon and Federation. I'm like, what? Since when? You know, these are three. You know, superpowers in the galaxy that have been at odds for decades, and you're telling me that at some point off screen they decided to work together? And I mean, the joke is that it failed miserably, and it's literally just this disgusting outpost in the middle of nowhere. But I digress. Yeah, weak plot. Sorry.
So your grade number?
Two.
Did you give one?
I gave it a two.
Wow, I was actually I'm usually not generous when it comes to these things. Yeah. All right,
like I said, those 2 points only come from the message behind the whole plot.
Yeah, exactly. Cast.
Here's where we get to really find some meat in this movie.
Yeah, the full cast is back. They do act very weird, though. We'll get to why in a minute, but let's talk about the villain. Leonard Luckinbill plays...
Lawrence Luckinbill,
I'm sorry. Lawrence Luckinbill plays Cybok, who's Spock's crazy brother. This is crazy. The original person, the original actor that was thought of for this role... was a little busy. Of course, I'm not as good as Daryl Hammond is, but I'm of course talking about Sean Connery was picked for Cybok. I don't know how Shatner would have allowed that, because you would have clearly been lowest billing if you had done that.
Yeah, completely overshadowed by the performance.
Yes, but Sean was busy, and we'll tell you with what later. But Luckinbill did a fine job. He was good. One of his last roles, I know he passed away.
No. Is he dead?
Oh, no, he's not. I'm sorry. He's 85. Oh, wow. Okay, he's older. My bad. He was married to Lucy Arnaz. I didn't know that.
He still is, I think.
Wow, they have five kids. Is. How old is she? Is that who I'm thinking of? Oh, it is who I'm thinking of.
Yeah, Lucy and Desi's daughter.
16 years apart. She's 69. He's 85. Okay, my bad. I thought he was dead. He was good. He was good. He was tasked with what to do, and I thought he was good. He was charismatic. He wasn't aggressive like Khan, because there was no revenge or anything. He was on a journey, and the only way he was going to get this journey was to skirt the rules, pretty much.
Yeah, it's actually a really solid performance. Like the story goes that Shatner saw him in performance as LBJ, stage performance, and he said, this is the guy we want. And yeah, you know, you've got this not quite a Vulcan. You know, the big reveal at the beginning is he pulls the hood back and he sees the ears. And the guy's like, oh, you're a Vulcan. He just starts to laugh. So right from the beginning, they're like, oh, something's going on here. But he commits. Like you said, I agree. He's very charismatic. You know, he's essentially this space cult leader, or, you know, portrayed as such. So he gathers all these people to him to, you know, fulfill his quest, as he puts it. But he's big. He's natural. It's an excellent performance. It's just, you know, lipstick on a pig at this point.
A cripple fight. Yeah. Sorry, I like that. You said that in the off the air. I thought that's still one of my favorite lines ever now. That's my favorite techism ever now. Yeah, he was great. So we'll grade him separately, obviously, under the villains category. Otherwise, on the other side of the coin, clearly one of the most wasted opportunities, or shall we say unnecessary castings, because you could have cast a coffee mug in this role and it would have been perfectly fine. One of yours and my favorites ever, and for a lot of you listening, probably one of your favorites in the anything genre, pop cult, you know, sci-fi, action, whatever. David Warner plays this throwaway sleazebag, ambassador, or, you know.
Yeah,
And
he's the Federation ambassador to this crappy outpost.
Yeah, and he's
Sijin Talbot.
Yeah, even a cool name, but why bother? He's barely in it.
It's such a waste. Yeah, like you said, I agree. You could have cast anybody in this role. It's such a minor role. He's barely important to the plot. Like,
yeah.
And it's David Warner. David Warner is amazing. You know, cite whatever you want. You know, his turn as Jack the Ripper in Nick Meyer's Time After Time. You know, the voice of Ra's al Ghul on Batman the Animated Series. His hilarious return as in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. Tron, for God's sake. You know, you don't hire David Warner and just, like, relegate him to this C-tier role in a Star Trek movie, nonetheless. Thank God we would get to see him not once, but twice again in Trek as a whole. It's a consolation prize. Total waste.
Let's take a moment. David Warner, of course, 79 and thankfully still alive. Let's take a quick check of things that people would know him in, okay? He was in The Omen.
Yeah.
That's one of the first things I ever saw him in, was The Omen. He was in The Concorde, Airport 79. Time After Time, as you mentioned. Time Bandits. Remember, he had the fucking black rubber condom on his head, but he was still awesome.
It's Ivel!
Yep, he was Ivel. Yes, he was Ivel. As you mentioned, he was in Tron. He was in The Man with Two Brains. He was in this. He was in another movie of this ilk, which we'll talk about momentarily, or in the next episode. He was in, as you mentioned, Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze. In the Mouth of Madness. He was in Money Talks. I didn't know that. He was in Titanic, for Christ's sakes. Scream 2. He was the narrator in Pooh's Grand Adventure, The Search for Christopher Robin. He was in the shitty Planet of the Apes.
The Tim Burton one, yeah.
Yeah, the crap one. He was in Mary Poppins Returns. He was he was the admiral with the cannon on the roof.
Oh, I never saw that.
Yep, I didn't either. So, and of course, and he was in Avatar.
He was?
Yeah.
Like, he James Cameron, Avatar?
Joseph Lau. I think so. Oh, no, it's a different Avatar.
That's the episode of Batman the Animated Series.
Whoa, this is something different. Avatar, also, wow, look what we just learned. Avatar, also known as Matrix Hunter, is a Singaporean sci-fi film directed by Kuo Jian Hong.
Oh, no.
Wow, David Warner. Sorry, not that Avatar. Well, when I looked at the date, 2004, I probably should have known. But anyway. And then TV, I could just roam down the list. Remington Steele, Heart to Heart. He was Bob Cratchit in George C. Scott's A Christmas Carol. Murder, She Wrote, Perry Mason, other shows pertaining to this franchise, which we'll talk about later. Lois and Clark, Babylon 5, Men in Black, the series, Toonsylvania. And, of course, as you mentioned, both Batman and Superman, the animated series. Mm-hmm. Detective.
The best.
God, he should have just said that in Star Trek V. We would have been fine.
I once saw him at a Star Trek convention, and I regret to this day that I didn't actually meet him.
Right.
But I saw his talk on stage, and I'm just sitting there going, I wish he would just end every sentence with detective.
Detective. So great. Damn, it's so great. Utterly wasted here. Yeah. For that, I give the cast a 5.
Okay, that's fair.
I can't elevate the grade just because the original 7 are in. After a while, you give them their base grade and try to grade everybody else, and I think that's just it didn't hit the cylinder this time.
I think I'm going to be a tad more generous. As I alluded to before, I think the cast is one of the things that kind of helps make this movie watchable and enjoyable, particularly the big three, the Kirk, Spock, and Bones, most notably the opening scene at Yosemite National Park. It opens with Kirk scaling El Capitan, or at least a fiberglass facsimile of it.
Facsimile, yes.
And Spock, of course, shows up with his rocket boots to, you know, check on his progress. And then you have McCoy down on the ground, just like muttering to himself. I think it's very well written. It's really in line with the characters. But the button on it, of course, is the scene around the campfire where, you know, they're trying to teach Spock, you know, how to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat to just kind of enjoy the camping. And he pulls out his marshmallow, or his marshmallow, as he calls it. And Bones has the wonderful line, you know, God, I liked him better before he died. It's fantastic. Like, the byplay between the three of them is spot on in that scene. And of course, we get a reprise of it, if you will, at the end when Spock has his lute and starts to play Row, Row, Row Your Boat. On top of that, you get a good chunk of them in the scene with Cybok in the Enterprise Observation Lounge, where Cybok is having them deal with their pain, which to some in the movie may consider that his way of brainwashing. But you get this really strong performance out of DeForest Kelly, where he is faced to relive when he had to essentially unplug his father off of from life support. It's a really powerful performance from DeForest Kelly. And they said that after shooting that scene, he kind of had to leave the set and spend some time by himself just to kind of get over it. Cause he, you know, cited his own relationship with his own father to kind of channel into that scene. So I give him points for that one. There's one line, it's so small, but I love it. It's when they get back on the Enterprise after they've been camping, and it's a very awkwardly shot scene. They get into the turbo lift and the camera doesn't move, and it's only focused on Kirk and Spock. Like, there's clearly other people there, but it's only on them. And Kirk just says the line, I could use a shower. And Spock just looks at him from the side and goes, yes. And I find myself using that response in everyday life.
Yes.
Somebody will just say something like very obvious and I'll just look at them. Yes. Just the way Leonard Nimoy says it.
I've seen you do it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's, you know, that's fun. Like I said, the Yosemite scene is great, and there's some solid but going back to that scene in the observation lounge, you know, he forces Spock to, you know, face his pain, which is of course his own birth, but Spock doesn't buy into it. So but at the end of that, you get this really cool moment from Shatner where he has the famous line, you know, I don't want you to take away my pain, I need my pain, you know. And it's a cool line, and you know, for a lot of people it's truth. But while all of that is well and good, there's a lot of weird stuff in this movie when it comes to the cast, particularly the seemingly random all of a sudden pairing of Scotty and Uhura. which is hinted yes. at early on, where she kind of comes on the bridge and kind of gets really close to him. He's like, I brought you dinner. And he's like, oh, Uhura. And you're like, is something going on here? Because there's never been, and it's really weird. And then, of course, there's Uhura's fan dance in the desert, which I'm sure Nichelle was thrilled to sing. If that is her singing, I honestly still don't know if it is, because there's a version of that song on the soundtrack, and it's definitely not her. It's a completely different singer. And then there's what I call the missed opportunity, which is when Cybok comes on board with everybody and he throws Kirk, Spock, and McCoy in the brig. And right before he does, you get this one shot of Scotty in the shuttle bay. Like, nobody sees him. He kind of sees what's going on, and he very quietly moves out of frame. And for anyone who doesn't know the movie, they may get the impression like, oh, we're going to get like Die Hard with Scotty, where, you know, the ship has been taken over by all these bad guys, and he's the one who's like running around, because, you know, who better to be moving through the bowels of the ship than the guy who knows it better than anyone? And it's completely wasted. They miss out. All you get is him, you know, busting them out with the, you know, amusing line, do you not know a jailbreak when you see one? But the final insult is when he tells them, like, where do we have to go? He's like, oh, you go down this shaft, turn left, whatever, whatever. And they go, you're great. He goes, oh, I know this ship by the back of my hand, and bangs his head on the bulkhead. And it just undermines everything about Scotty.
I know.
I know it's played for laughs, but it's a cheap laugh, though. Yeah, it is. Absolutely, it's a cheap laugh. So while I do love the big three byplay, and I do think Lawrence Luck and Bill's performance is very strong, there's a lot of weird stuff going on in that movie. Some bizarre performances from the Klingons, that's for sure. Very over the top, very unnecessary. And, you know, then it's weird when, like, Chekhov and Sulu are brainwashed, and they're like, oh, you know, but he's here to help us. It turns into a cult. So I'm going to go one notch ahead of you and give the cast a 6.
Okay. So you will give it a 6. Okay. All right.
Villain.
We don't have to go too crazy here, since we talked a decent amount about him. I thought he was fine. He realizes the error of his ways at the end, that he got duped. So I'm going to... I'm going to give him a 5.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that range. I was going to give him a 6. Okay. Yeah. Like, without retreading, we've got a charismatic villain, which is different. You know, it's not someone who's angry or evil, or, you know, like Christopher Lloyd or Khan or anything. But it's a good performance, and that gets most of the score. But like you said, he turns into kind of this sympathetic character at the end, when he's so convinced that he's right, which is, you know, the way many good villains are written. You know, good villains don't see themselves as villains. They see themselves as the hero of their own story. So here he is, you know, everyone with me will benefit from this, from what I'm doing. And then, of course, he's faced with the reality of it at the end, and chooses to sacrifice himself to help save everybody else. So I'm going to give him a 6.
Mm, okay. Production.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah. This may be where we literally circle the ball. Rock people.
Let's just jump into it now. Let's just acknowledge the elephant in the room now and not dance around it.
Yeah, and to be fair, we can't rate the movie based on something that's not in it.
That's true. That is true.
Oh, the Rockmen. Oh, Rockmen. I want this whole army of Rockmen. Okay, for those of you unfamiliar, the climax of the movie on Shakari, which I don't think we mentioned this, was named for the actor who didn't get the role of Cybok.
Exactly.
Yep. Sir Sean Connery. Kirk is running from the threat, and there were supposed to be all these terrifying rock creatures coming out of the ground and chasing after him, and I think supposedly breathing fire. And as he tells the story, there was room in the budget for one Rockman suit. All right, well, we'll build one and, you know, shoot it a bunch of times, you know, composite. And then they built the suit. What was it, $350 million? Oh, no, sorry, $350,000. Yep. Is that correct?
That is damn expensive styrofoam.
Yeah, styrofoam fiberglass bodysuit, and then a big animatronic head, which is where I'm convinced the majority of that money went. And then, of course, like, oh, does he breathe fire? No, we can't get a fire rig in the face. It'll burn the actor. Oh, my God. It was just doomed to fail. Thank God it's not in the movie.
Yeah, I can't. There's no. Oh, here we go. Well, the big issue effects wise. Boy, 1989 was just bad luck for the Shat in this movie, because the last three movies, Trek crossed the relative imaginary line of demarcation to the other star. And had ILM doing their effects. Now, we all know ILM. They kick ass and take names. So, but they were too busy doing other things because it's 1989. Mm-hmm. And they had other movies they were doing.
Yeah, two better. Other big sequels.
Better ones. They had to go elsewhere. Yeah. It definitely didn't have the same look.
No.
You know what I mean?
Oh, God. No, and that's because, yeah, they went with this other effects house out of New Jersey. I can't remember which town. I honestly can't even remember the name of the effects house. Starts with a B, I think.
Effects houses. Brand Farron's Effects Company Associates and Farron was picked.
That's it, yeah.
So, they worked on films such as Altered States, which is actually a pretty good movie. And Little Shop of Horrors. Hiring the New York-based studio made The Final Frontier the first film in the Star Trek series produced on both the East and West Coasts.
Yeah, because they had to, since they had their pre-existing models of both the Enterprise and, because we see the Bird of Prey again in this one, those had to be sent from California to this place in New Jersey. So that right there, you know, there's another red flag. Like, you shouldn't have to do this.
No.
But yeah, this is a big problem with the look of this movie. Is every composited shot of any kind of spaceship in this movie, Bird of Prey, Shuttlecraft, Enterprise, looks like ass. It's flat. There's no lighting effects. It's just a shot of a ship composited onto the starfield. It's flat. It's poorly lit. There's absolutely no life to it. Everything looks terrible, just terrible. And they claimed that it was because they ran out of time. Now, believe that if you will. I don't know if it was that combined with the fact that these guys just were nowhere near ILM's level. You know, we had four straight movies of top tier special effects in terms of model work and compositing with, you know, a dash of CG here and there, you know, the Genesis simulation and the time travel thing from Star Trek IV. And what an enormous step back with all of that. Just, you know, if these guys had done four, I think we could have given them a pass, because as we stated in our last episode, it's not a very effects heavy movie.
Thank God
they didn't still, though, but still.
I know.
Yeah, it just, everything looks bad. Like, Bush.
It looks cheap.
Yeah, it looks cheap. I mean, everything's short of just having the strings in the shot.
It's this franchise is Never Say Never Again.
Yeah. It's funny. I was going to say this is the Star Wars holiday special of Star Trek.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah,
that was that a TV budget.
I have that note right here. Mm. Yeah. But yeah, the composite shots. Dude, the menu on the DVD looks better than the effects in this
movie. Yeah, really. Yes. I think I said that when I put mine in it. Oh, my God. It's
so
great.
Like, they opted to go with rear projection effects for the view screen and. Normally that looks okay. Like, they do that in the next movie and it looks fine. They've done that in previous movies, but the bridge was poorly lit. You know, there was, it's just like they just had the studio lights in the ceiling And just I just turn them on. It's fine. It looks nothing like the bridges in the other movies. Like that takes away from it. It just looks rushed and incomplete. You know, the phaser effects look bad when they're assaulting Paradise City. I mean, they fire a photon torpedo at the end of the movie, and all of a sudden it's green and like crackly and everything. I'm like, you had set a look for this stuff. You know, the torpedoes are little balls of light, you know, with like rays coming out of them. And all of a sudden you've got this ridiculous thing. I'm sorry. Oh, and then there's the glaring continuity error. I'm sorry if I'm getting way too nitpicky here, but
no, please continue. It deserves to be nitpicked.
There's the scene in the turbo shaft where Kirk and company have to get from the brig to the bridge. And not only do they enter the turbo shaft on the bottom level, which, all right, sure, it would make sense to, I guess, put the brig on the bottom level. But the shaft goes all the way to the top of the ship. Now, if anyone knows anything about Star Trek, the Enterprise ship design, there's no point on a starship, or at least on the Enterprise, where you can access the topmost deck, which is the bridge, and the bottommost deck in a straight line. Because the deck is at a slant and so on and so forth. In addition to that, as they go up, the deck numbers increase, which is also incorrect. The bridge is deck one, and the numbers increase as they go down. And lastly, when they reach the top of the ship with Spock's rocket boots, they reach deck 78. I've never seen a starship that tall in Star Trek.
I know, my God. It's like a World Caribbean ship.
Again, I'm putting my nerd hat on and pushing my glasses up. The Enterprise has 21 decks, everybody. Come on. Let's do a modicum of research before, you know, doing your set decoration.
You should know better.
I hate to say it, but Herman Zimmerman, who is the production designer on this movie, is a legend. The man has been doing, I assume he's retired by now, but he's done some big stuff in his career. Stuff which is Star Trek. He's the production designer on this movie through Nemesis, as well as, you know, the Star Trek spinoff series. You know, it's his sweater was the basis for the pattern behind the transporter in Next Gen. So yes. I got it like, Herm, what were you doing, man? I mean, come on.
I agree. I'm giving the production value a 2.
Oh, I'm giving it a 1.
Wow. All right. Look at you.
It has next to no redeeming value to it. Like I said, the sets on Nimbus 3 just look terrible. They look recycled from a completely different movie. The composite Dune. Effects, not even. God, they would have been lucky to have the sets from Dune. It's just bad. And then, you know, all the way to the end, you know, you've got the face of God, which is just, you know, this glowing composite of George Murdoch's face. And then at one point, the Bird of Prey fires on it, and it's literally a shot of William Shatner perched on a cliff, and somebody just set off like a dozen Roman candles at his feet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's rough. However, the final category is might be the saving grace. It might be the highest weighed thing on this grade.
Spoiler alert, it is.
It is. Music critic Jeff Bond wrote that the Shat made at least two wise decisions in making this movie. The first, of course, choosing Look and Bill as Cybok. And after taking, which is funny because he didn't do a note of the trilogy, Old Ponytail himself returns. Jerry Goldsmith is back.
The Maestro.
Yes. I don't know how much it helps the movie, but it makes it sound good at least.
It sure does. Jerry Goldsmith's triumphant return to Star Trek.
Yes, thank God.
Is this dumpster fire of a movie. But he nails it. He absolutely nails it. This is the first of four instances where he starts with the, you know, his build. You know, he starts with the Alexander Courage theme, and then it just builds and then blasts into his Star Trek theme, you know, from the motion picture, which was then used for Next Gen, which has just become synonymous with him and to many just Trek in general. Yeah. And he adds a little bit of synth. You know, you get some electronic elements in this score, even right at the beginning, because when it transitions from the Courage theme into his theme, you get kind of this synthesizer. I've heard it described as like a turbine, like spinning up, just this like,
right.
Yeah, very electronic sound, and just, you know, hits you in the face with this theme. And then, you know, a beautiful piece that plays during the opening with the climb, you know, his piece at the end when they're on Shakari is very ethereal, you know, very, you know, got this kind of, not chimes, but, you know, like little like synth hits and everything.
Right.
The biggest standout, a friend of mine who taught me everything I know about film music described this as Jerry Goldsmith's Star Trek theme by way of Rambo, because the scene when they storm Paradise City, the track on the soundtrack is called Open the Gates. It sounds like Rambo. It's just got this really cool, like, Jerry Goldsmith drums and horns and strings, and it's a really cool action piece. So, yeah, he definitely helps make this movie listenable, if not watchable.
Right, yeah. Yep. So, it adds a nice, classy, symphonic, typical Jerry feel to it. Last time Jerry was here, we gave him a perfect 10 for the motion picture. I wouldn't say this is perfect, but it's definitely better than probably the last few, because the soundtracks have gotten progressively more average in the trilogy. That might have been the one grade that suffered during the 2, 3, and 4. 8.5.
Yeah, I give him a 9, because it's just he doesn't retread a lot. You know, you get your theme, your Star Trek theme, which is just great to have it there for that sense of normalcy and everything. But he brought a lot of new stuff to the table in terms of just the sounds and you know, for a lot of these scenes, particularly the action scenes, because that was one thing that was sorely lacking. As good as the score to the first movie is, he didn't get to score any action, you know, because as we stated, it's just a lot of meandering. You know, you get your big bombastic stuff, you know, the main theme and the Enterprise and all that. But even the Klingon theme, as cool as it is, it's very mysterious, very quiet. But here, like I said, with his touch of Rambo, touch of that kind of thematic action scoring, he definitely steps it up in this one.
Yep, absolutely. All right. We're going to give our final grade, and then we'll talk about the sad landscape, or the great landscape that this poor movie had to sit through. So I can't believe I actually graded this higher. Not by much, though. So for you, plot 2, cast 6, villain 6, production 1, music 9, for a total of 24.
Can I actually, now that I think about it, I need to amend my score.
Okay.
I need to give production at least one more point, because while everything special effects wise looks terrible, there are some pretty cool locations in this movie. Obviously, yes. Yosemite is picturesque and gorgeous, even though he's not actually climbing that mountain and the campfire scene is clearly on a set. But they shot the Shakari scenes at Trona Peaks in California, which is a very spectacular, very alien landscape with all these, you know, vertical rock formations and everything. So I got to give him one extra point for that.
Okay.
So bump my production score up to a 2.
So it's a 2, same as mine. So now you're a 25. So now you're ahead of me. I did plot 4, cast 5, villain 5, production 2, music 8.5, 24.5. Okay. Now, 1982, when Wrath of Khan came out, as we mentioned, it was in the midst of a blistering year for genre movies, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, etc. But Khan held its own. This movie came out June 9th, 1989. The first time a Bond movie,
the first time they kind of bounced back and forth between June and the winter, because Star Trek III came out on my birthday in 1984. Then they went back to November in 86, and now they went back to June in 89. Now, Final Frontier was expected to make a ton of money. It was a Star Trek movie, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. In what might be my favorite part of this episode, we are going to, I'm going to let everyone know what came out throughout 1989, various movies, and we'll see what kind of competition Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, had to endure, similar to what Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, had to endure 7 years earlier. I'm not going to give every movie, just the ones that actually did great and are memorable. Who's Harry Crumb? The Fly 2? Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? Lean on Me, great movie with Morgan Freeman. Police Academy 6, City Under Siege. Fletch Lives, which didn't do as well, admittedly. Leviathan, good movie. Heathers, which was an underrated one of those coming-of-age flicks that would be kind of a cult classic as time progressed, Winona Ryder, Christian Slater. But April to June is where the heavyweights came in. We had Major League, Say Anything, great movie. A new tech favorite, Kickboxer. Field of Dreams. Pet Sematary. Let's see. Roadhouse. All right, here's the first real heavyweight. May 24th. The reason that Sha'Carri couldn't play Cybok. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Also one of the two reasons ILM did do the special effects of this movie.
Exactly. They were busy doing something better. Dead Poets Society. I know I'm going to say this. I know it didn't do great, but No Holds Barred, because Hulk Hogan's in it. Then on June 9th, this is rough. This is rough. The month of June 1989 is rough. And not rough in a bad in like bad movies. Rough in I feel bad for fucking this movie. June 2nd, Dead Poets Society and No Holds Barred came out. And laugh at No Holds Barred, but Hulk Hogan was hot, so you know, he was world champion, so. Then June 9th, had it all to itself. Star Trek V, The Final Frontier came out. The following Friday, June 16th. The other thing ILM was working on, Ghostbusters 2. Yep. And then the following Saturday, the following Friday, June 23rd, 1989, the Friday that changed everyone's viewing and everyone's movie watching and movie thinking and comic book movie thinking forever.
Do you want to say it or should I?
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Oh, wait, sorry. That was the other movie that came out that day. No. Be my guest, sir. That is right. Who are you? Yes. Yes. Michael and Jack came out that day, and fuck that shit. Yep. That movie was making money at Christmas. The only movie I have ever gone to the theater to see three times. Three times. We're not done. We're not even close to done. Continuing the competition of 1989. Also that month was Do the Right Thing and The Karate Kid Part 3. Then in July, we had Weekend at Bernie's, Lethal Weapon 2,
The best one, in my opinion.
The other sequel that shit the bed in 1989, one we talked about on our previous series, License to Kill. We won't waste more oxygen. We won't waste more oxygen on that. When Harry Met Sally. What people need to also remember is that all three horror franchises had movies that year. Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan came out. The Abyss, which was a well-looked-forward-to horror movie. Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child.
Halloween.
Okay. Yep, that's coming up. There it is. October 13th, Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers. Let's see, what else? My Left Foot, All Dogs, Harlem Nights was a good movie, Eddie Murphy. This was also the year that Disney started to rejack up its animated. The Little Mermaid came out.
Oh, yeah.
Steel Magnolias. Oh, Back to the Future Part 2. Duh. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Driving Miss Daisy. Glory. Born on the 4th of July. So, needless to say...
You forgot UHF.
Oh, I did forget UHF. UHF, well, I didn't forget. I know about UHF.
I know.
UHF! Yeah. When did that come out? That came out July 21st. Squeezed in between License to Kill and When Harry Met Sally. And then the following Friday was Babar the Movie. Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. And... A oft-forgotten Tom Hanks classic, Turner and Hooch, directed by, in case you didn't know, Tech, directed by future Bond director Roger Spottiswoode.
Needless to say, a juggernaut of a summer movie here.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has yet to be seen again.
On a side note, just to give everyone an idea. Over on the other feed, the Place to Be Wrestling Network, on the Place to Be podcast, JR and I are doing the MSG house shows, and I do the Pop Culture Corner. When we went through all of the 1989 shows, and I am not kidding with you, I think into January of 90, Batman was still making money. I'm not kidding. I think when we were doing the 1990 Royal Rumble, which was the third week of January, I swear I still think Batman was making money. And that's what, 6 months? Fathom that. This movie got crushed. Crushed. $33 million budget, $63 million profit. Ugh.
Yeah.
Not good.
Just barely made half of what its predecessor made.
Yeah. Not good. On the other side of the coin, in terms of making money, actually, I'll look at it at the top of the screen. Here were the top 10 moneymakers. The highest grossing. Do you want to do worldwide or domestic? We'll do worldwide. Actually, no. We'll do domestic because I think it's domestic. So it made $63 million. Dead Poets Society made $95 million. And that was 10th. Parenthood made $100 million. Back to the Future Part 2 made 103.8. Ghostbusters 2, this is domestic, United States, Canada. Ghostbusters 2.
Panama, hey, did you make a
person? Excuse me. Sorry. What's that?
Nothing. Oh.
Ghostbusters 2 made 112.5. Look Who's Talking, 120.4. Rain Man, 125.6. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, 130.7. Lethal Weapon 2, 147.3. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, 197.2. And the final domestic gross, Batman, 251.2. However, worldwide gross, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade actually made more. 474.1 to 411.3. I think a lot of that is Indiana Jones had more cred. Remember, overseas, comic books are not as... overly sexy.
And when you have like a globe-trotting, you know, storyline, it helps in the foreign markets a bit.
Right, exactly. I gotta find this. I know we're going off the path, but I gotta ask him while I have him here. If you put Batman
in today's numbers, does it make more than Endgame?
If you
do that $411 million, well, I guess it makes more than let's put it this way: is the $1 billion that Endgame made, that's domestic, right?
That's a great question.
I'm assuming so, because I'm just curious.
It gets to the point where you just hear numbers being thrown around, and they tend not to it made $858 million domestically. Endgame, Avengers Endgame.
Okay.
It crossed the $2.5 billion worldwide.
So
let's put it this way: Endgame made almost $400 million in its opening weekend.
Yeah. Now, mind you, in 1989, tickets were what, $4?
Yeah.
Now they're
significantly cheaper. 12.
So yeah. I want to click on the movie because I'm curious to see we'll look it up off air. But in any event, the whole point of this last segment here is that Final Frontier got destroyed. it was officially a bomb.
Yeah, it bombed. To put all this in context and make all of this worth it, it really begs the question: if it had been a quality movie, would it have been swallowed up the way it was? Or was it just doomed from the get-go amidst this sea of cinematic history?
Well, let's put it this way. I would contend, if you flip-flop the movies and put Khan in 1989, I think Khan would have held its own.
Probably.
Khan would have held its own against these sluggers. This didn't. It's just not a good movie.
No. Like,
it's just not good.
It's one thing to have, you know, a good word of mouth. Like, people go see it, like, oh, Trek 5 is great, you should all go see it. No, when people are walking out, they're going, I don't know, man.
It's crazy.
Star Trek 5, death of a franchise. Almost.
Yeah. I don't see like an aggregate of what making. So the previous month, opening weekend, Last Crusade made $37 million. Batman's opening weekend broke it with 40.5. So, well, I think we need to talk about this movie down the line. Yeah. I feel another series on the horizon. Anyway, this is what happens. We use one series and then reference something and then think of our next topic. That's what we do here at Place to Be Pop. It's all symmetrical. Anyway, that'll do it for this episode of Pop Goes the Classics. I think we spent a good amount of time talking about this piece of crap. We'll be back next week here on the Pop Feed with the next installment, which is considerably better, both because David Warner has a better role. we have another tremendous acting performance, one warrior to another, and just a better story. And it is officially the farewell of the original series cast, sans the captain, because he'll obviously show up in one more. So there we go. We'll be back in a week with the final chapter of the original series cast. He's Tech. I'm Scott. Don't see this movie, or see it, and then watch Batman.